The MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the MadTech Podcast. My name is Lindsay Roundtree and I am CEO at ExchangeWire. And today I'm delighted to join my two colleagues, Rachel Smith, CEO at ExchangeWire. Hello.
Hi there, Lindsay Roundtree.
Lovely to have you here.
Thank you very much. Lovely to be here.
In person.
Yes, quite exciting.
Feels rare.
Forgotten how to do it. Couldn't plug the microphones in properly.
No, it was a bit of a nightmare. But it's because somebody, not naming any names, not in this room right now, tied them up terribly. So it was a nightmare.
John Steele.
Okay, names have been named. He's going to love that when he listens back to this. And also welcome Matt Broughton, research lead. Hello.
Hello, Lindsay.
Lovely to have you here.
Wonderful to be here in person.
In person.
Many, many, many moons since that's happened.
So exciting. Before we get into our stories today, I want to remind everyone that today, as in day of publishing of the podcast, so the 4th of October, is the final day to get your votes in for Adtech Personality and Adtech Rising Star. You can find links on exchangewire.com in the description of this podcast or in today's version of the Stack. And if you aren't subscribed to the Stack, why not? That's where you'll get all your information.
Get your act together.
Absolutely.
And we've had
so many votes, right?
Oh yeah, thousands.
Amazing.
Thousands.
Keep them coming.
It's looking good.
It's very exciting, actually.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Watching really them all roll in.
Some really good names being celebrated in the industry.
Yep.
Yeah. Love it. Anyway, on to our first story. So our first one comes from DigiDay and it is the rise, stall and fall of Oracle's advertising business. So Oracle Advertising concluded its business on Monday, sad face emoji. This brings to a close a turbulent ending for the computing giant's advertising business, which once led the market. So first, I bring you a timeline, because I love a timeline. Oracle's first serious foray into the ad business was in 2012, when it acquired both Vitru and Eloqua. This was followed by acquisitions of Datalogix and BlueKai in 2014. Then came AdThis in 2016, Moat in 2017, and finally Grapeshot in 2018. The sum total of these acquisitions over the six-year period works out to about $4.2 billion. I must point out that both Eloqua and Vitru are not directly affected by this shutdown, this exit. They actually sit within different business units, but over time were kind of said to be part of the Oracle Advertising unit, or ODC, Oracle Data Cloud as it was then. Oracle Advertising's peak revenue valuation was about $2 billion in 2022, so quite different from the amount that everything was bought for. Mm. But that sadly plummeted to around $300 million at the time of its exit this year. So it's obviously sad, but maybe not particularly surprising demise for a business unit that generally had such promise at the start and at the peak. Question to you both, and Rachel, I'll come to you first on this one. What do you consider went wrong and the main reasons for Oracle exiting advertising? And, you know, what do you think we as an industry can learn from it?
Just remind me of the totals then, Lindsay, of everything that they acquired. What was the total price
tag? It was around $4.2 billion.
Right, and $2 billion was the height of their revenue, advertising revenue. So I suppose one of the things that you could say is if you were to, and I've got no idea what these look like off the top of my head, but if you were to get into detail on what they paid for each of those, in each of those acquisitions, were some of those companies overvalued? Did they pay over the odds for them? They certainly acquired a couple of those companies during a time of fierce competition in the M&A, on the M&A side of ad tech. So people were acquiring businesses all over the show. And I would also say that some of those Oracle acquisitions happened off the back of big ad tech players such as Meta and Google having gone through a good couple of years of acquisition. So I feel like at that time there was this sort of sense that if you wanted to be a successful ad tech company and you were already quite a large software or technology business and you had some money, you should go and buy some companies.
You were a shoo-in.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I guess if you had deep pockets, which Oracle did at the time, then you paid what the going rate was. But in hindsight, with the benefit of hindsight, perhaps we can look back and say that some of those companies were overvalued. We may well have even said it at the time. Certainly something common that comes out of Kieron's mouth is that ad tech companies are overvalued.
Yeah, I imagine you probably did. I think, what was it? Moat was 2017. That was $850 million. And Grapeshot, which were the two at the time, you know, BlueKai around $400 million, but that was a little bit back. Mm. And then Grapeshot, the most recent, to 2018, that was $400 million.
Yeah. It's quite a lot of money for the types of businesses.
For what they were.
Types of businesses that they are. And then I think the second thing that I think about when you ask the question, what do you think went wrong? And we only know this with the benefit of time having passed. I think they made those acquisitions and then tried to integrate those businesses into their advertising offering at a time where privacy legislation was really starting to ramp up, and perhaps no one could really predict much at the time exactly how that would impact the industry, because it was a bit difficult. When was GDPR implemented again?
2018, I believe.
Yeah, so probably around 2017, 2018, it was a bit difficult to forecast exactly how much of a wide-reaching impact the entire sort of privacy legislation movement was going to have on the advertising industry. For a long time, we thought that might also just be contained to Europe and might not necessarily fan out in other markets. And of course, that's not what's happened. It's become the mainstay of consumer marketing, quite frankly, not just digital advertising. So I think that's had a massive impact. We're talking about a series of businesses that were effectively all geared towards making Oracle's third-party data solution as enticing and targeted as possible. So probably a fantastic third-party data suite of tools, but not very usable in modern advertising and marketing. And some of that they couldn't have known at the time, but some of that they probably did get a good inkling of along the way, and maybe they didn't act fast enough or make fast enough decisions. There was something else I read that said the real issue is that Oracle was never an advertising style business that could have inventory of its own in order to create their own first-party data segments that they may well then have been able to add to the data segments that they were building out through all of those other tools.
And you wonder as well, there's a comment made by a former staffer in this Digiday article that said that when GDPR was announced, you know, BlueKai lost 85% of revenue in Europe, and it made for a very tense atmosphere in the business, obviously, understandably. And you do wonder as well, you know, Oracle, this massive, massive software business, they normally kind of, they operate in a certain way, a very different way to advertising and ad tech. Do the two just not mesh? Like, Matt, what are your thoughts on this?
I think it's very reminiscent of the telcos coming in to wide acclaim to the ad tech industry and just not being able to make things work harmoniously. And I think in terms of what the industry can learn from Oracle's demise is don't rely necessarily on these really hyper-aggressive roll-up strategies where you just, you know, acquire loads of similar businesses, great businesses in their own right, but they're all really exposed to third-party data. And obviously, yes, hindsight is a wonderful thing, but, you know, conversations around privacy, you know, it's not like European legislation like the GDPR just suddenly comes out of nowhere. There's years and if not decades of conversations around this. So they should realise that they could be exposed to this. I think a kind of analogy would be, say, Criteo, for example, obviously traditionally being quite heavy in the retargeting space. It'd be like if they decided, right, let's buy up any kind of company involved with retargeting. We are now the kings of the world in retargeting, when everyone knew it's not necessarily the strategy to go for. As it happens, what Criteo has done, which maybe Oracle hasn't done, is that they've gone, you know, they've pushed hard into retail media. They've gone into that kind of neutral middleware space with the IPOM web acquisition, to the point that now retargeting is less than half of their revenue. So they've been able to adapt and pivot. And I think where Oracle, one way they may have gone wrong is that, you know, reading the Digiday article, they restructured key teams like the ad tech sales teams 3 times in 1 year. And to me, that just seems a bit daft. Obviously, you've bought these companies, partly, yes, because of the tech and because of the data, but also because of the expertise in that those businesses. Yes, you can make optimizations, but to completely restructure teams 3 times in a single 12-month period just seems a bit daft.
I mean, I've witnessed that kind of thing in a few businesses. It's you understand sort of why it happens. Like, they come in with the first restructure with very good intentions, and then they go, well, that, and also don't forget, Oracle had no idea how these businesses really work. Like, that wasn't their bread and butter. So they're kind of going, well, we need to try and integrate BlueKai and Moat and Grapeshot together somehow. How are we going to do that? Let's do this. And then they go, oh, that was shit. That didn't work at all, did it? Let's do it again. And then before you know it, you're basically left with a bunch of really disgruntled staff who don't know what's going on and don't know what each day is going to look like. And it does feel like, do we all agree that there is actually, maybe these kind of businesses shouldn't be buying, like, they're just so different, and actually you have to really kind of get the right expertise in from externally to ensure that you are able to integrate these businesses, rather than just like do a Google and take them off the market just so they're not kind of being competitive anymore.
Well, I think that's a really good point, right? Because I think that there was a narrative around at the time of some of Oracle's acquisitions that was sort of double-edged, right? There was the, oh yeah, this is interesting. Look at all of these larger companies buying up data solutions, data and technology tools that are going to help them build out an advertising business. You know, this is great for the growth of the ad tech industry and a testament to how much digital advertising is going to, you know, take over the advertising world, which was inevitable. But then the other side of that was, and what type of businesses are those that are doing the acquiring, and exactly what are they doing them for? Are they doing them to build out their own capabilities, or are they doing them, as you've described, Lindsay, to take them out of the market? And companies the size of Google and Meta did just that with a few tech businesses that they bought, ad tech businesses that they bought, and they can afford to do that because they've already got massive engineering teams that are focused on massive advertising businesses. But if you've got effectively a software company like Oracle buying data tools and solutions to build an advertising business, but, and as you've alluded to, Matt, not necessarily got that expertise in-house, but you've acquired it, and that's not your wheelhouse, then it's going to be incredibly distracting trying to work out how to make all of these things work internally. You've got the staff and talent management that you've mentioned. You've also got the technical integrations. And then I think you need to ask some questions about what the strategic vision was behind this. I think the real problem here is that Oracle acquired a series of businesses that were not necessarily massively differentiated from their competitors in the market, and they acquired them at a time where, although the market was hot and heating up, it just meant that there was so much competition around. People that had first mover advantage were far more likely to be successful than you were. And they just already had a number of things that put them sort of behind the starting line. And not being an ad tech business was one of them, right? And not being in the advertising business was one of them.
But it made sense at the time though, right? Because there was a time when MarTech and AdTech were so very, very distinct, and this felt like a really good way of actually showing, listen, we need to bring them together. And there was, it was around that time, it was around the sort of 2016 to 2018 time period where there really was a consolidated effort across the industry to kind of show that they're not so dissimilar, let's bring them all together. Does that feel like it's breaking apart again, and we're actually, MarTech and AdTech are two very distinct different things?
I think it's probably testament to the complexity of these disciplines, right? I think it's not the case that you can, that, you know, that all technology tools and solutions within, under the umbrella of marketing and advertising are equal. We know that some perform a particular function and cannot be, you can't execute good marketing and advertising campaigns without them. Others are a good add-on, and there's lots of examples of those technology solutions, and whichever one you go for might be down to particular demographic requirements or particular relationships that you've got with technology tools and solutions. And I think that starts to speak to the complexity of the disciplines. So I think you're right, it did seem to make sense at the time, but I think that we didn't know back then what we now know about the direction of data in personalized advertising and data targeting in personalized advertising. I know that sounds a bit naive, because you're right, we did know GDPR didn't fall from the sky. It was a piece of legislation that was worked up over a number of years and a conversation that was being had in the industry for a number of years. But I feel that we were back then quite naive about the full impact that it was going to have on the industry. The other thing is, which I think is a really important point, because it goes for both the success and failure of businesses, sometimes it's timing. And I think the timing
was
just
bad timing,
really
wasn't it?
Bad for Oracle. And some of that, again, they couldn't have known about ahead of time, you know. IDFA sort of landed not that long after the acquisition. Data privacy then being rolled out in the US, data privacy then being rolled out more, you know, sort of comprehensively across European markets. Other markets that didn't have any privacy legislation in place just suddenly deciding that they should adopt the same sorts of principles. I'm not sure you could have predicted the timing of all of those things coming together.
No, that was a shame. And I'm also thinking about, you know, this is not related to ad tech, but, you know, the likes of Unilever buying Dollar Shave Club back in the day. And, you know, we had Unilever on stage talking about it, and they said, when we bought Dollar Shave Club, we were told, you're the oil tanker, they're the speedboat. Don't touch them. Like, let them carry on, do their thing. And that feels like, I mean, it didn't work out that well because they sold them last year. But it does feel like, you know, it's very, very difficult to integrate two such different business models. You go raise the example there of Criteo and IPONWEB, Matt, which is a very good example. Do you feel like there is opportunity for companies. This shouldn't be a negative story. That it could have, I mean, timing, as we've just highlighted, was a factor here. Do you think that companies can make acquisitions work, but they have to be more aligned than maybe Oracle and their acquisitions were?
Yeah, I'm not necessarily sure it's so much in terms of alignment. I think it's more, if you're going to make acquisitions, what are you doing it for? Is it either additive in the sense that you're adding the expertise or the technology and you really want to, you know, harness that and use that to build your business, which, yes, you can say each individual business within the Oracle unit that they bought, yes, it could have done that. But to get all of them, it just seemed like they were having a game of supermarket sweep and just trying to, or Pokemon, collect them all. Like, it didn't necessarily seem to fit that strategy. Or you go down the Critia route of going that diversification piece where you're in a sector which you're not, you know, you're aligned to, but it's not necessarily one where you play well in or have played well in, so you want to have that expertise and technology within that new sector to be able to capitalise on that.
I mean, that's totally right. And if you aren't from the UK and didn't experience supermarket sweep growing up in the 90s and 2000s,
it was
a brilliant game show with Dale Winton. You were given a supermarket trolley or shopping cart, whatever you want to call it, and just told to go mental in a supermarket, just like ranging things off the shelves into the trolley. It was brilliant. Anyway, on that note, I'm going to move us on to our second story, which is a promotion between Prime Video, Amazon's Prime Video, and Odeon. So I said Odeon really weird there.
I know, which made me think, have I been mispronouncing it all these years?
Odeon.
As I was saying it, I couldn't work out if I was going to say Odeon or Odeon. I don't know why.
And it came out Odeon.
Yeah. I've never said Odeon in my life.
I like the excitement of that. How am I going to pronounce this word? I'm not quite sure. Oh, look, there it's come out.
Yeah, and that's there it came out. I might say Odeon going forward. Anyway, Odeon, for those who don't know, is a cinema chain in the UK, and they've partnered with Amazon's Prime streaming platform to bring discounts and promotions to consumers. Between the 1st of October and the 7th of November, consumers who purchase an Odeon cinema ticket across a range of new films will get a 40% discount on a selection of electronic sell-through films on Prime Video. If you're not quite aware what electronic sell-through means, I had to look it up. Basically, it's a buy and keep option. So it's not options for you to rent or stream. You have to get this discount for buy or keep stuff, which is the things people don't do. They normally stream, they normally rent them, right? Anyway, the offer will be redeemable for 1 month after cinema ticket purchase. Promotion is called Go Big and Go Home. Yeah, very good. Yeah, like that. And we'll give Odeon Cinema Goers a discount code for a selection of 70 films across Amazon Prime. So, Matt, I come to you first. Big cinema goer?
No. I'm one of these lapsed cinema goers, which...
Yeah, I'd have thought you would have been a cinema goer.
So would I.
No, I like watching films, but cinemas are very, very pricey.
That's right.
Yep. That's also true.
Yep.
I want to get your thoughts on if you think that, obviously the intention here feels like it's to get more people going to the cinema. Will it get you going to cinema? Do you think it's going to be effective?
I want to be kind here, but no.
But I'm going to be honest. Sometimes that's kind as well, Matt.
But when reading through like the statements they released as part of the announcement, they're really going after this piece of attracting the lapsed customers like myself who have been to the cinema in the past, love watching films, but just haven't been over recent years because of obviously cost prohibitions or other factors. Per base CEO Liz Bales, their aim is to increase frequency for attendance in lapsed and light cinema goers. And I just don't think this deal will help. Like, the economy is still a bit wobbly. So if people can't justify, $4.99 for an ad-supported Netflix package, which still has a bucket load of films, and or £8.99 for a Prime subscription, why would they spend £20 on a cinema ticket to watch a single film only to get a couple, £2 or £3 discount on a film they'd watch going forward? It just seems a little... I think it's the right idea, it's the right intention, but I just don't think this is appealing enough as a deal, as a concept to really get lapsed cinema goers back into the films.
I mean, I'm the same as you. I'm not a massive cinema goer. Largely, I always, a film comes out and I go, oh, I'd love to watch that in the cinema, but then
vanishes. Yeah. It's on for about 2 weeks, and if you miss it, then that's the end of that. And then it's on Sky.
So I'm like, I fine, watch it on that, and I just can't be asked half the time. It ends up being now, Rachel. I know you went to cinema recently because we were talking about it, but I mean, would this get you going more frequently? Do you think that a promotion to be able to buy, and we've got no idea what these films are, you might look at the list and go, well, that's rubbish. I don't want any of those films. problems is it going to make me go? What are your thoughts on this?
Well, see, this is the interesting thing. I wondered if actually the opportunity in this is the other way around, and it's less about getting more people to go to the cinema, and it's more about getting cinema goers to visit Amazon Prime more regularly. They may or may not take advantage of the 40% discount to buy a film. They're obviously making an assumption, Amazon and Odeon, that people that are more likely to buy a film are going to be cinema goers because perhaps they've got some favourite films, or they've got a love for film that means that they will want to purchase something and keep it. But even if they don't, maybe the trick there is to even just get them to go and visit the Amazon Prime platform, realise what other things might be available, and before you know it, you've got a subscription where you didn't have one before. It does seem like an odd promotion for all of the reasons that you've just gone through, because I think as a cinema goer, and I've been a lapsed cinema goer for a long time, but I've recently in the last couple of years gotten back into it, it's all about the experience, isn't it? It's not just the joy of watching a film because you enjoy watching films because you can do that at home, but the cinema is about the experience of watching it in the cinema in a big screen. And these days, you know, we had Claire Turner from Pearl and Dean Advertising on the podcast a couple of weeks ago. She shared some really interesting stats with us that actually cinema audiences are growing strongly in the UK, and they're almost back at pre-COVID levels, because obviously COVID wasn't great for cinemas, but things have bounced back a lot. But the category in which they're growing is, I want to call it, luxury cinema experiences, right? So it's not just, you know, the Odeon on Streatham High Street where I live, which is actually a medium to not very nice cinema. Ooh, best way to describe it.
I wonder where you're going with that.
Medium to not very nice cinema experience, compared with the Everyman, which is pure luxury cinema experience. And so Claire was telling us, and some of this was data. She had some data to back it up, but she
the literal opposite of anecdotal.
Yes, exactly. But she was sharing some of this outside of the podcast that. Luxury cinema chains are growing very strongly in the UK. And so therefore that hints to the idea that it is all about the experience. And if it's all about the experience, then yes, I can see how maybe a special offer might tempt lapsed cinema goers or might remind them to go back to the cinema. But it's not going to be a reason that I will go to the cinema, because I go to the cinema for those big films that I want to see there and the lovely experience. And when I'm at home and I'm using Amazon Prime, it's all about streaming. It's not, you know, they're two separate experiences in my mind. And I think some of the data about cinema going and people returning to the cinema underscore that. They're going for a particular experience, and it's not to get a 40% discount code and go home and download a film that they like from Amazon Prime.
And it feels like, because obviously the purpose of this is to get people buying films, not subscribing to Amazon Prime
Film Platform. Which also seems like an odd, I would have thought the
incentive. Is that the way you would have gone? Yeah.
I think that there's an opportunity. So that's why I'm saying maybe the opportunity is to get people to go and explore Prime. But then you're going to sell them subscriptions. You're not going to sell them one-off films to download, because who pays for and downloads films?
It's people who watch that film and have liked that film and have probably already downloaded it and don't need the incentive of, okay, I'll spend 20 quid to go and watch another film in order to get a couple of quid discount on this film.
Yeah. And I don't know. I mean, you know, it brings up lots of questions about how you watch films. I do definitely rewatch films, but I probably only rewatch them a couple of times. But I'm also someone that doesn't reread books. Music, on the other hand, listen to it all day, every day, repetitively. So for me, you know, downloading music totally works because you want to have it so that you can listen to it whenever you want. Downloading films, it's not like the old days of the DVD collection or the VHS collection. You don't need a copy of those films.
Feels a bit Blockbuster, doesn't it?
It does.
It does. Yeah, it definitely does.
Yeah. But it's a nice idea. You know, I'm hugely supportive of anything that's going to support the film industry, because film is still so, whether it's at the cinema or whether it's in a streaming environment, it's such a fabulous medium, right? You know, it's still distinctly different to the box set, distinctly different to anything that's shorter form, and it's just such a wonderful creative kind of, you know, format. So
And it's in partnership with some major distributors. So Lionsgate, Paramount Pictures, Sony Pictures, Studio Canal, Universal Pictures UK and Warner Bros. Discovery. So clearly for all of these people, it's about film. And that's why I guess it's not about subscriptions to Amazon, because you can stream tons of stuff, not just content from these distributors. It's about specific film ownership. So I understand the purpose of it, but it just feels like it's got a bit of a long way to go.
I'm
interested to see how it actually goes.
One thing that I was just thinking when you were talking there, Lindsay, I suppose the other opportunity might be these days when a film turns up at the cinema, like Kneecap, for example, really wanted to go and see it. Well, you had a hot minute to get into the cinemas to see it because it was on for about 50 seconds and then gone and not yet widely available on streaming platforms. However, if I'm sitting in the cinema and I'm seeing trailers for a film that I know is already on at the cinema, I'm not going to get a chance to see it, and I might get a discount to download it, then I might do it. But all of those things have got to stack up timing wise. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Good luck with that.
Indeed.
Odeon and Amazon Prime. Let us know how it goes.
Good luck, guys. Yeah. We'll hear from you, hopefully. Yeah, let us know. On to our third story. So Microsoft will start paying publishers for content surfaced by Copilot. Isn't this interesting? So Microsoft's announced it will start paying publishers for content that appears in its Copilot Daily, clearly a knockoff of Dot, by the way, a new feature of its AI assistant, Copilot. The feature pulls insights from authorized content sources to provide users with a spoken summary of current events, including the weather. I mean, Dot doesn't give you the weather, but it gives you all the best ad tech news.
We can try on that day.
I was about to say, I think maybe that's add-on for
fine. We'll add the weather.
Start getting it. Give us the ad tech weather.
So publishers signed up to Copilot Daily include the Financial Times, Reuters, Axel Springer, and the person that wrote this wrote Alex Springer, and I almost read that out, which made me laugh. Alex Springer and Hearst.
Hang on, Axel Springer Alex works at Axel?
Alex could be, he's the founder of Axel Springer.
He just loves it so much he's named himself after it.
Got it wrong and mistyped his name.
Misspelled it at the registry office.
Yeah, it made me laugh. Axel Springer and Hearst. It's yet to be revealed how much publishers are being paid, but this is positive, right? I mean, it's not across all of Copilot, which sources all of its content from across the web, but it is recognising the benefits of publishers and recognising they need to be paid. Rachel, I'm going to come to you first. You know, it's tough. It's ongoingly tough for publishers, and publishers have their views around the different AI platforms. Do you think this is a positive step?
I mean, you know, revolutionary paying publishers for their content.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Good Lord.
Yes. Can you imagine? I think it's fantastic. It's what should become commonplace. We should start getting ourselves as consumers, and also from the perspective of businesses and business models, back into the mindset that publishers need to be paid to produce the quality content that they produce. They have to pay their journalists and their staff and their researchers. That is exactly what they should be doing. We have to uphold those principles, those disciplines, those professions. So all hail any business model that is returning money back to the publisher. I'm not that surprised, because we're starting to see a range of, you know, AI-powered tools and solutions that are also providing subscription models that promise to return that money back to publishers. So Perplexity AI is another one. And I think that's going to be the business model of the future, I think, for, you know, AI research and conversational search engines. But what's interesting I'm finding so far is that no one's disclosing how much of that money gets returned to the publisher. So I think that's one really important part of this, is that those sums need to be meaningful. A bit like, as I mentioned earlier on, music streaming platforms, I want to know that the money that I pay Spotify somehow ends up in the hands of the music creators, because that's why I used to go to the record store and buy the records. And that's why we used to buy the newspapers and the magazines. So we need to start understanding how much of that revenue is being returned to publishers.
Matt, what are your thoughts on this? Do you think that this is positive? Do you see any negatives for publishers? And do you think that there might be a little element of obfuscation? Like, if you look at this hand, look what I'm doing here, you can't see what I'm doing with my other hand behind my back. You know, not just from the likes of Microsoft and Copilot, but also, you know, Apple with Apple News since the dawn of time, whatever, how that's been going for. Perplexity, OpenAI, everybody else. What are your thoughts on this?
I completely agree with Rachel that it's incredibly positive that publishers are being paid for their content. Do I think it's enough? I'm extremely skeptical on deals around this in terms of generative AI, given the serious questions about the capabilities that the model owners have to modify those data sets. Yes, it gets trained on the content. It pulls out a lovely briefing. Does that content then get wiped from the database? I don't think it would. Will people click through to the publisher's website and in turn obviously get, you know, ad revenue to the publisher for looking at those ads? I don't think that would necessarily happen on an audio briefing. So in terms of the money being paid, would that then fairly compensate the publishers for that? I don't know, because nobody discloses anything anymore. So yeah, I'm extremely skeptical. And I think other examples, so in terms of Reddit, they did a $60 million deal with Google to basically, you can scrape our entire site, happy days, which it seems very short-term gain for actually you're really going to compromise your content, which is what you are as a site going forward. And I think, yeah, it's, but also as an aside, the statement that Microsoft released announcing these changes was just fucking awful. Copilot will be there for you, in your corner, by your side, and always strongly aligned with your interest. It understands the context of your life while safeguarding your privacy, data, and security, remembering the details that are most helpful in any situation. Over time, it'll adapt to your mannerisms and develop capabilities around your preferences and needs. I don't want my computer learning my mannerisms. Absolutely. It's an internet browser and a software program.
That's right.
Fuck off. Stop being so creepy, Microsoft. No,
said in Matt's best creepy radio voice.
I love that. I was just about to say the same thing. As you were reading it out in your best radio creepy voice, how creepy. It was making it sound literally like a robot following you around.
Copilot is your friend.
I don't want it to be my friend.
I don't want a friend. No, Dot is not your friend. Just to be clear, Dot brings you daily ad tech news. It's not claiming different. To be anything different
completely
than that.
You don't want your friend. She provides a service. She's too wild for that.
She is wild. Yeah,
but I think that's a really good point. What would as you were saying that, Matt, voicing, sharing with us your skepticism, which I can see is completely founded. What would be a better business model? Because it's as though those AI tools are going to be using that content and information forever, arguably. Because, like you said, it's not like they'll use that content and information, learn from it, and then bin the information. So it's almost as though those AI platforms need to be paying a subscription model to publishers and content providers, and saying we'll pay you this much money per month or whatever to have access to this volume of content, which I guess was partly what the Australian government was trying to do with their media bargaining code with the likes of Google and Facebook, was to say, if you're going to continually use our publishers' content, then you should negotiate with them on an annual basis how much you're going to pay them for that. But it feels as though there needs to be some ongoing value exchange, not just with the consumer, because the consumer needs to understand that too. I'm accessing this information, and so therefore someone's providing it for me, and I want to make sure it's quality information, and that entire value chain is has some integrity. So if I pay for that, perhaps that's a way to guarantee that or contribute to that. But then those that are providing that information also need to pay for it as well.
Because it's a question around, you mentioned value exchange there. Is it, and this ties in with the point you were making, Matt, is it a value exchange for the publisher? Because as you said, Matt, like, well, certainly from an audio perspective, if they're listening to this Copilot daily, whatever it's called, can't remember what it's called now, something like that, they're not going to necessarily click on a link and go and look at that publisher. So is the publisher actually getting any power here? Yeah, they're getting some money for all their stuff being used, but they're not actually getting any real brand awareness. It's not, they're not being cited via audio, I imagine. So are they really winning, or are they just getting paid off?
Precisely. And I think that if they're, I think that a big question mark remains there. Are they really winning? Not really. But then maybe what we're talking about is a different type of business model altogether for publishers. And it's less about publishers as a brand and more about publishers as a service. And so they therefore do need to be compensated for that, because they're providing a service.
P-A-A-S. Pass.
Pass hangs out at Odeon.
Yes,
Odeon. Yeah. But I think, you say it's a new business model for publishers, but I think it needs to be, they need to heed the warnings of what's gone on in the past and just look at, the revelations that have come out at the Google DOJ trial. you know, I've got a list of them here. Gannett having to can 2/3 of its workforce while ad revenue from Google collapsed. Google charging publishers 36% in ad tech fees while generating $31 billion from them. Changing SERPs to keep people in the Google ecosystem. Large publishers totally beholden to big tech. And, you know, you've got 4 out of 5 News Corp ad dollars are coming from Google. 3 out of 5 Daily Mail ads are coming from Google. And it's just a case of, you know, search is a really useful utility, but in terms of what the publishers have got from that, and obviously, you know, an example in 2020, Google announced it would pay $1 billion over 3 years to publishers for Google News Showcase. And obviously, you know, publishers, it's $1 billion over 3 years. Happy days. We'll get involved with that. But over that time, Google generated $848 billion in revenue. 0.11% of that going to those publishers as part of these deals. It's crumbs. And I think we need to look at, in terms of, as you say, whether it's a model where big tech firms pay more to the publishers and on a more subscription basis, and obviously include the local publishers in that, because they're the ones that have really, really struggled, because they tend to be excluded from these deals. Obviously, with this, you know, Copilot story, you've got the Financial Times, Reuters and Axel Springer. What about your local publication for your local town, local village?
Well, it's, they always not, lose out.
Yeah.
But you're totally right. And I mean, that's what came out in lots of negotiations that Google undertook with large publishers to effectively pay them off. The argument that they kept using was, but we provide you with, you know, sort of brand visibility and we send people to your site. I wonder how important that is. I know that if I was a publisher sitting in the room in a, you know, with a strong brand, I would say it's critically important that people come and visit my site. I understand that. But I wonder how relevant that will be in another 10 years' time when we're all using AI-generated, you know, research and conversational search engines. Because think about the newer wave of, or the, you know, a younger wave of consumers who at some point, or probably already even now, don't really understand what news publisher brands are because they consume their news via social media platforms anyway and barely recognise or notice the sourcing references or visit those publishing sites. So I'm not saying that I want that world to occur, but if we accept that it might occur, then I do think that we need, you know, I'm sure publishers are already thinking about this, but I do think it would be good for them to be really front-footed about thinking about how they make sure that they are not being paid off and that they are not the poor cousin that just gets, you know, some sort of hush money and carries on producing all of that work. There's got to be a better, more credible balance here. I'm not sure entirely what that is, but there has to be an acceptance somewhere along the line that those AI tools are being powered by content that is being produced by businesses that have got to pay for that content to be produced.
Yeah, and I think as well, on top of that, you've got to look at, in terms of how governments are working with big tech firms to ensure that they're getting, you know, required tax dollars, tax money from those, and it isn't being pulled out of the local market. Like you flagged Australia earlier as an example. Facebook claimed that it only generates $34.7 million in profit off of $1.26 billion of revenue. That's advertising is one of the most profitable sectors going, and it's, you know, 2%, if that, because it's pulls out that money and attributes it to Facebook Ireland. So it's a case of actually, you need to be able to work with the governments to make sure the tax stays in the local market, which then means the government will be able to support the smaller local publishers, as well as obviously the deals being done with the big tech firms and the larger publishers, to make sure we're getting the entire market involved and included, not just those at the top.
I do love a Matt stat. We should have a segment called Matt Stats.
Oh my God, we should.
Yeah, that would be good, wouldn't it?
That's a great idea. Yeah. Matt Stats.
Yeah.
New podcast. But I mean, you know, all very good, all very interesting stats and really good points, Matt. I think that's the problem though, right? This is a very complex area of sort of business regulation, consumption trends and habits.
And these gardens know that, and that's why they can just, it's a bit like the ruling in California that's come out recently, that Google have said, we will pay X amount to all local California publishers, and all the publishers and the locals are saying, you know, it's a combination of tax and money from Google and everything else, and the publishers have said, well, actually, that's fine, but you're kind of, you've made the decision and you've not allowed the government to make the decision. And if they had done, they would have made it probably more fairly than what you have. And it now looks like you've gone, oh, we'll come in and save the day. And they're good at this.
Always beware of the person that turns up at your front door with a big, brown paper bag stuffed with cash.
or donuts. I take donuts. But yeah.
Donuts. Oh, I really want a donut now, Lindsay.
Oh, no.
On that note, I'm going to end this conversation
because so before it goes
wildly off course, so we can go get some Crossland donuts. Exactly. Yes. Thank you so much for joining me, Matt and Rachel.
Pleasure.
Been an absolute pleasure.
It's been wonderful. And thank you for listening as always. We will see you next time.